Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we're looking at Lord of the Rings, the original Fellowship of the Rings. And to join me on the quest, one podcast to rule them all, Mark Christensen. How are you, sir?
Great, Mike. Nice to hear you.
And also joining us is Matt Graham. How are you, Matt?
Hello, I'm all good, thank you.
So we're going to be looking at the Fellowship of the Ring, the first of the Lord of the Rings series in our series where we go back and look at some terrific films from days gone by, and with the, I guess, clarity of 2020 hindsight, review and assess them from a visual effects point of view. But as with all films now with the VFX show, we also like to have a topic that contextually places it in terms of the VFX history or the moment where we are with technology. And in this particular case, I think nothing more so than the advent of massive crowd simulations and, of course, what became the massive software. Though at the time of this film, the massive software wasn't existing as a separate company as it is today. Massive was something that sort of came out of the development work done by some work that actually we'll discuss later that Peter Jackson himself kicked off and explored. And I want to start with you, if I can, Mark. Obviously, as we do, we'd like to just see if you liked the film or not. So I guess when this came out, did you like it? Did you think it was a good film?
Oh, absolutely. At the time it came out, I was blown over like everyone at how really it was an epic film that did not pull its punches. It really didn't feel like they had to limit what they were trying to do anywhere. I think it felt like a huge film and massive. It was certainly a part of that. It feels a little redundant to say massive was part of the hugeness. But and also the use of restraint of effects in this. Now, when you've got a story this solid driving the whole thing that your director knows inside and out and has carefully brought to life, that will lead away from, hey, let's do this effect just for its own sake, which is something we always kind of are less fond of, I think, on the show. And this is a prime example of effects that really just serve, one of the most, one of the biggest and most epic kind of archetypal stories out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should clarify which version of the film we're looking at, because there was the version released in the cinema. Certainly my version, the one that I like, is the special edition DVD edition. I actually got the four-disc DVD when it came out, and that has about 30 minutes of additional material added in. Matt, did you get the original version?
I started with the original version, and I thought, why the hell am I watching the original version? And quickly went out and got a copy of the extended edition. And it's a very, very, very long film.
It is very long. Can you give us your quick appraisal on what you just thought of as a film, full stop?
I loved it. Like, when it first came out, I was caught up in the hype and just amazed with everything. And you look at some of the films that were coming out the same year. I mean, you had Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone and Pearl Harbor and Planet of the Apes. But, you know, I just think Lord of the Rings really blew everything out of the water and raised the bar again.
I guess we should clarify whether you guys were Tolkien fans going in, or whether, because if you were a Tolkien fan, it really did kind of influence your view of the film. Mark, were you somebody that had read the books?
I read the books as a kid. I am not a Tolkien nerd, and as we get into it, I'm anticipating that I'm going to offend the Tolkien nerds out there with the vague way in which I talk about things about which they like to be very specific.
Matt?
I think I'll offend them even more because I have yet to read the books.
Okay, so I will confess that I was a Hobbit book fan, but found Lord of the Rings hard going when I was a kid, partly because I'm partially dyslexic and partly because I'm a slacker. But I did love the films immensely, so we'll try and get it as right as we can. But if we could put a disclaimer that when we say nerds, we actually mean it in a loving way. And yes. Also that if we do get the names of anything wrong, we do apologize, but please, it's all with the good intent. So let's move now to the visual effects work per se. And of course, one of the astounding things is the rise of Weta Digital. So Weta Digital started with Heavenly Creatures, which I thought was a good film. You guys see Heavenly Creatures?
Yeah.
I thought it was a good film, but it was pretty small in terms of visual effects.
Was that before or after The Frighteners? It was before, wasn't it?
Before, yeah.
Then there was Frighteners, and then which obviously had more visual effects, but still it was a relatively small company. To go from that to what is now considered one of the premier visual effects facilities in the world and on par with, you know, literally any of the big houses, and to be so showered with nominations and Oscars for, and rightly so, for brilliant work right from here to Avatar. I believe I'm right in my stats in saying there are about 260 people at Weta when they did Fellowship of the Rings, and they did about 580 shots. But these were guys that were working, let's face it, a few years ago now, because this is 2001. So about 10 years ago, and to put us in context, we're talking SGI workstations and just a bunch of technology that we these days would consider to be pretty ancient, Mark.
Yeah, like Shake, right?
So I think that Weta did an outstanding job, and there's just no question about it. It just was one of the most remarkable risers of a visual effects team. I will also say, though, that Richard Taylor, who headed up the miniatures, well, it was really the prop unit, really, wasn't it? Yeah. The Weta workshop.
I mean, Richard and Peter had been working together for years, all the way back from Meet the Feebles and Braindead, and they always loved making great adventure films.
So I guess for me, I want to discuss a few things before we get to Massive itself. But I'm going to ask you, Mark, were there aspects of this in terms of its visual effects that that you sort of centered on? Was it the entire package, or were there any aspects that really stuck out for you?
I think partly it's the everything, including the kitchen sink approach to effects in this. And looking more into the behind the scenes, they clearly didn't go into it with a big plan. It was not a master plan film. They didn't have any one approach for anything. And they had a director who, as you say, to many people's surprise, was very savvy about visual effects, enough that on the back of these films, you're right. I mean, yeah, he built Weta. And
not just visual effects, though. I think he also is very into special effects. And
He's really into special effects and embedding the two together. And I was really impressed in this movie how well the two were integrated. I look at it now and I can pick apart some of the shots that way, but it's just still such fine craftsmanship and really inventive use of sometimes very simple techniques. I even get the feeling that the filmmaker is most proud of those.
You know, the other person I think we really need to give amazing kudos to is the insanely brilliant Andrew Lesney, the DOP, because I think that his collaboration with Peter Jackson, which has spanned from those films through Kong through to today, is an immensely powerful collaboration. And Andrew has that, I don't know, it's kind of a can-do attitude, a very relaxed, not fazed by anything, but having said that, is very open to just doing it. If you've got a clever, simple way of doing it, then just do it. And I think that that resonated with Peter Jackson. I actually met Peter Jackson and Barry Osborne at the beginning, before Lord of the Rings came up, and they were looking at the color timing process, and I said basically a flame demo with them to discuss whether flame would be a good thing for doing color correction on it. But it's kind of hard to imagine today what it was like back then, pre-Lord of the Rings, because, as you said, Jackson, while incredibly wired and great, just hadn't done this kind of a film before.
No, I mean, he had big visions in his sights, though. I mean, he took over Weta. Weta was the Wellington government-funded filmmaking company, and when that was going bankrupt, he stepped in and brought it out and then has built it into the empire it is now.
For me, well, let me, I should ask you first, I guess, Matt. What was there anything in the visual effects? Because Mark said that it was like the totality of the inventiveness of it, and I think that's a great point. But was there anything for you in terms of the visual effects that you just were like focused on?
Well, I always, you know, anything bad always sticks out for me, and then I work backwards from that. So for me, you know, some of the background replacements and just not seeming to float and not having the right kind of depth of field always stuck out. But then when I go back and see all the other bits and pieces, which are just simply amazing, especially the massive stuff and the force perspective stuff, It's, yeah, that stuff is incredible.
Actually, I'm really glad you mentioned the Force Perspective stuff, because that's the thing that I would put my hand up for, is the vote of I just love to death. And I therefore credit all of the people from the production design to Andrew Lisney people for actually doing this, because it's so, I think the thing I love about this film, apart from the fact that it's a good film, I love that it is such a huge miniatures film. It's such a huge, clever in-camera tricks film. And yet, of course, it also had such amazing digital stuff as to do with the massive and the crowd replication. Now, when you get to the later films, like second and third film, Gollum tends to dominate one's thinking in terms of the technical visual effects. But in the first one, we didn't really have Gollum in that big sense of a character that was a standalone character. And so for me, I was just intrigued beyond belief with not only the use of force perspective, scale composition and stuff, but it was the fact that they did force perspective with a moving camera. Mark, have you seen any of the behind-the-scenes footage of that?
Yeah. And they show, it's actually on YouTube. Anybody can go find it really easily, some of it. And in the commentary track, they even point out a couple of the little mistakes that happened along the way with it, but you really don't pick them very easily. And it was so clever and a little hard to comprehend how you would use a counter move between the camera moving one direction and a kind of a platform rig moving the other direction to allow moving the camera that way. That's one way they did it. Another was to just do multiple passes of blue screen.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, let's take the shot of at the beginning, Gandalf's on his cart coming in, and Frodo jumps on the cart, and then he's sitting beside him on the cart. Now, if I saw that, I'd be like, well, there are scale problems here. It's probably going to have to be a comp. But Frodo meets him on the Virgin Hill, and that is a shot which is pretty much just playing on eye lines. You know, Frodo is looking and standing further back, so he looks like he is smaller, and he is looking in a direction where the other actor isn't. But of course, from the camera's point of view, it looks like his eye line is correct, and thus you believe that Frodo is smaller. Frodo jumps into Gandalf's arms, and in that jump, they're using a body double. So the body double is actually wearing a face mask that was prosthetic, that was sculpted on the actor's face but shrunk down obviously for a smaller actor. So you now have a body doubled physical actor jumping into Gandalf's arms, which Gandalf can then grab and have all the interaction with, and we now have a scale reference that's interacting. He's then sitting beside him as the cart moves. We now have a forced perspective where the Hobbit is sitting back, the wizard is sitting front. They're like literally about half a meter to three quarters of a meter between them. And if you know the maths of it, the Hobbit is 0.75 to the height of a human. So if I was a meter and a half, you'd multiply that by 0.75 to get the height of the relative Hobbit. What that means in terms of force perspective is they have to be 1 1/3 further away. So if any distance that you would go to Gandalf, you have to be 1 1/3 further away and place your Hobbit character, whoever it is, to make them look the right size relative to Gandalf. And so therefore, he's sitting on a seat further back, and yet in camera they're getting a shot that is done. I mean, it's a brilliant in camera shot that actually has the two of them riding on this darn cart as they go forward. And then you'll cut to close-ups of Frodo sitting there talking to him, and that's on an oversized cart. So now they've gone for a replica of the cart in an oversized sense, and they cut back to Gandalf, second cart, which is the normal size, of course, and then you just cut between them, and there you go. You've got like a bunch of techniques, none of them at that point digital, that have got you a lovely sequence that is just enchanting. It's an enchanting, simple sequence. But I mean, how brilliant is that? That's the kind of filmmaking. I mean,
a lot of
we
planning.
Need more of that.
Yeah, a lot of planning and foresight.
I mean, also, the table in Bag End is split, so Gandalf is sitting at a table, half of the table that's one scale, and the half of the table that is closer to Bilbo is in his scale, and there are some cups and pots and things covering the joint, and then at one point, actually, in the commentary track, they point out that Gandalf bumped the table. So, in fact, they completely blow the gag if you're watching for it, but who is?
I know. And as that motion control camera moves around, they motion control his, again, off side of the table to creep in to counter for the perspective shift that you'd have from the parallax of a closer object. It counters it out and you just believe that it's one scene. I think it's just brilliant.
I had the impression that motion control is a little too sophisticated a term for what they were doing. They were using a mechanical, I mean, they were using everything motorized and it was all kind of wired together, but I don't think there were, you know, I don't think they were recording data in any kind of sophisticated way here.
Well, it's motion control in the sense that the motion is controlled, and it's not motion control, as you say, in the sense that we were data gathering or doing repeatability and multiple passes. Because let's face it, in terms of why you would want to do motion control, you know, the number one thing is normally repeatability these days. You want to be able to do the same shot. And they did that. They did several times in the sequences. They would do same passes, but with, for example, different camera distances to subjects so that actors looked smaller and other ones looked bigger. And that was a ratio multiplied motion control adjustment. But as you're right, in this particular case, it was more like motorized control of the rig as opposed to motion control from a mathematical computer.
Getting the most
out of the
toys. Yeah. Right, and recording that data, yeah.
The other thing that it's hard to get past, and look, we're only in the first few minutes of the film and we're already in love with it, is, as you said, at Bag Ends, there's two entire sets built, right? The large set and the small set that feels like a submarine, that because it's, you know, you can't stand up in it. But and it never occurred to me until I heard the commentary track. Every single book, every single piece of paper, everything was made twice at exactly the same scale ratios. So can you imagine the exercise of not just crafting the art direction for that, but crafting the art direction for that twice at matching scales?
Yeah, sometimes even more, I think, because they had to have a large, small, and a medium version of everything. I mean, that there's two shots which just grabbed me straight away of the film, and one of them is when Gandalf's coming through that door and taking his staff and hat, passing him on to Bilbo. And, you know, if you see any of the making of stuff there, they actually had Gandalf with the, I guess, normal size stuff, and then Bilbo with the bigature material and extras passing them on seamlessly between each other to give that interaction, one on set and one on the blue screen.
I think another thing they did, which was really brilliant, to just sort of sell that stuff while we're still on this area of the filmmaking, is that Richard Taylor's group made these big rigs, which were basically enormous people.
Cool. I didn't know about those until I did a bit of research in the last couple of days.
God, I thought that was brilliant. Cool. So you'd have a shot, for example, in the bar, you have an oversized bar and they're looking up at it, but you want to have somebody move through the hobbits. And of course, if somebody moved through them, it's really hard to do that in any particular computer graphics sense. So they just had an oversized mannequin type rig on a person, in almost like a puppet, but it's somebody on stilts effectively. And they would walk through them. And of course, as the audience, we wouldn't be looking at that person's face. That person's face wouldn't even be on screen, but you just got that kind of mid shot of them bustling through the hobbits. And wow, did that just sell it or what? So look, I do think that and I could spend an entire podcast discussing the matte painting, because I think the matte painting in this film was magnificent. But I'm going to try and not do that because there are so many aspects and I want to kind of move through. But I can't pass over discussing what went with those matte paintings, which was a lot of the miniatures, or as they nicknamed them, bigatures. And I've got to say that Rivendell, which is where I think there was just magnificent matte painting, but also just the most amazingly detailed 24th scale miniatures, was one of the most beautiful, architecturally interesting, and naturally look, or sort of natural occurring, wild, foresty kind of environments. I just thought Rivendell was just a scene that just stuck out, that someone would describe that it was just drippingly beautiful and gorgeous, and it would be so hard to ever hit that for the number of shots that they were doing and stuff. And it was just a real treat to watch that sort of beauty on screen. And obviously the work they must have done in terms of matching the lighting for the dropped-in green screen elements into the Rivendell set. I mean, did anyone else think that? I just didn't see any faults with Rivendell. I thought Rivendell was brilliant.
Yeah, perfect.
Mark?
I mean, it's a magical land where it's always magic hour and, you know, fall. Again, it's almost over the top how perfect it is from a cinematographic point of view.
Yeah, the dedication to get that right was hilarious when apparently they gathered thousands of leaves up in the fall. And then, you know, of course they were shooting in summer and they had to repaint all the leaves that they'd dried up. And then Peter Jackson had all these people standing just off camera, just occasionally dropping leaves through a shot.
Oh, really? I didn't know
really
that.
Go to that much trouble is awesome.
Well, you know what? Go back to Baggins End for a second. That said, they planted all of the fields months before they were shooting.
Yeah.
So by the time they turned up for the shoot, the fields were actually had crops that were real in the fields, which I thought was just astonishing.
I suppose if you're going to make three films, and let's remember, they were making these three films back to back all at the same time, the mammoth effort. They really had to know what they were doing and plan things so they could, you know, get to the other end. It was a huge effort.
Yeah, it tied Apocalypse Now for the all-time record for a number of shooting days.
Well, apparently, you guys may have done this as well. I looked it up on the in terms of the stats of the shooting ratios and stuff. And as most people would know, you'd normally shoot, 12 to 1 all these days, maybe 25 to 1. If you're shooting digital, you might go up to 50 to 1. They shot a shooting ratio of 150 to 1. So instead of doing 500,000 feet of film for a normal kind of standard drama, they shot 5 million feet of film, 3/4 of which they actually printed through. So
it's like 8 hours a day of dailies.
Yeah.
Sorry, what?
It's 8 hours a day of dailies kind of thing.
Yeah, I just think it's astonishing. Yeah, instead of having like a half hour in dailies, you're there for hours.
It was at least 4 hours of dailies for Peter Jackson every day. It's like he watched the length of the uncut film every night after shooting.
They went to like 8 units at one point. I mean, it's one thing to go into second unit or third unit, but to go to 8 units?
You could see why you'd want to build your own lab and processing facility and audio mixing all in your same town.
Yeah, you should get Christmas cards from Kodak. Hey, does anyone... Was John Gilbert the editor? Who was the editor?
Cannot remember.
I thought it was John. Because the editing was amazing. And I actually really liked the recut DVD version with some extra stuff put in. But... It would have been an incredible... I mean, I don't know how big the editing team was. Anyone know how big the editing team was? Because it was like just a massive kind of Avid undertaking to process that much stuff into Avid and then just cut it.
I mean, seeing about a dozen people listed on IMDb.
If it isn't, John, I apologize. But you think about it in terms of visual effects. If you have that much stuff to pick takes from, it's terribly important that the editors get, you know, the right stuff for you, but also that you don't keep chopping and changing and redoing the work. But I mean, what a mammoth task. And you do Fellowship of the Rings and then you go, right, well, let's start the next one then. And let's start the next one after that.
It is John Gilbert, by the way.
Oh, cool. Great.
Did anyone find out what the shot count was for just the one film and all up the three films? It must have been
the visual effects shot count?
500 something?
Yes, 580. I think I said that already. 580. And, that was just Fellowship of the Rings. So continuing on, we hit Rivendell and I love it to death. But there were a lot of really good bigatures in the film. Lothlórien was pretty awesome. The scale of those tree housing kind of, what do you call it, really, the village up in the trees. So I think they had 8 26-foot tall tree models, which they were shooting. But, of course, they wanted a forest of these things. So they had 8 of these enormous... in fact, I think the thing that determined how big the scale was of basically any of the sets was just whether they could fit them in the building. But 26 feet high was as big as they could make these suckers. But they'd have to shoot those in 3 passes. So you'd have 3 layers of the same 8 trees to build up what they needed. And then, of course... heavy, heavy smoke in that sequence. I like those two miniatures probably the most, but the one that is perhaps most flashed as being like a huge bigature is...
the mines.
The mines, absolutely. And especially that crow hole shot, you know, where the crows fly down through the 3 caverns, this enormous tracking shot that had to be shot in 5 pieces that was just... unbelievable. 35th scale is what I have in my notes. And the basic bigature was the size of a football field, which is why miniature no longer seems to be an adequate word to describe it. 24 mine shafts, 1,000 pieces of separate architectural elements that were in it. But I'm going to ask you, Mark, just on screen, did that work for you? Did it feel like it was real? Did it feel like it was... because it's got impressive stats doesn't make it necessarily work on screen.
Oh, totally. I mean, now we've gotten used to these kind of shots. They're, you know, they've been in Hellboy, they've been in various other movies have used this kind of thing. But at the time, I mean, I could even pick where they kind of let themselves off the hook by passing from one room to another, or you can see, I mean, some of the guys standing there, you know, they're pin matched. You might pick up a little bit of that, but pin block that is. But basically, I mean, this that is a grand shot and it's really cool. And then when you find out how it was done, it's actually even more impressive because it's another one that just includes several different techniques, passing from digital to shot to miniature to some massive to some pin blocking, matte painting. You know, it's kind of it's all in there.
I guess for me, I'm not a big fan of the big flying through shot. Like, I know that it was motivated by the crows and stuff. And it's hard to say that because it's so technically impressive. But, you know, when they're approaching in the boats, the Argonauts, the huge statues with their hands out.
Yeah.
That, for me, was a more successful audience experience. It was more satisfying in terms of just so many aspects than...
Yeah.
And I don't mean that because I thought it didn't work... you know, technically, or it didn't work in terms of the story plot. It just meant, it just, I don't know, maybe I'm just a wuss, but those Argonauts just looked so brilliant, so well rendered, so well finished, so well thought out. They were, again, 60th scale miniatures, and I just...
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they were meant to be 300 foot high, you know, sculptures carved from the cliff faces, and then they realized that you wouldn't be able to carve them from the cliff faces, so then they reasoned that they must have had a quarry nearby, so then they built a little miniature quarry. Yep. And then they, if you look at them, they have brick style construction for the arms but not for the bodies, because the bodies were still cut out of the actual cliff. Yep. Face and I just thought it looked really good on screen. I remember at the time, I can still remember this, looking at that and just going, oh my god, that is perfect. And not only that, but it's magnificent, it's believable, and it could look hokey as all get out. It just looked sensational.
See, I remember a similar shot in Neverending Story, I think. So, for me, that shot's been done before, so I wasn't as amazed.
But you don't really think that shot from Neverending Story matches this shot of the Argonauts?
Well, no, but you know, it's a similar kind of story, whereas...
I'm calling you on that. That is, like, not even in the hunt.
I found the crow shot flying through the mines... far more exciting, because it was like, wow, I haven't seen this before. This is amazing. Bring it on.
You're just too hyper. It's a generational problem. Yes, Mark?
You know, there's a little detail in that shot that you're talking about, Mike, that really sells it extra much, where there's a bird nesting in one of the eyes, and it
really?
It gets scared of the helicopter approaching it and flies away. I mean, not that you should be aware of a helicopter making the shot, but... it's just that extra detail.
That's cool.
I love Weta. I love them. Okay, so let's leave the miniatures, which were exceptional, and discuss maybe some of the monsters. The Belrod, the fire monster that Gandalf tackles, the troll. I mean, how do we think the monsters fared in Fellowship of the Rings? Because they were, in many cases, digital. And it was pretty early for full-on digital characters. Mark?
Yeah, they had one foot kind of in Harryhausen world and the other in the future.
What was the name of the monster that was the like octopus thing that came up when they were trying to get through the door?
The Watcher? Was that called?
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Octopus thing.
Octopus thing? Yeah. I think all of those ones I've just mentioned were digital.
The Belrock was awesome. I mean, as soon as that came out, you wanted a big battle, and you know, you got it in the second one.
The fire approach of that, in case you guys don't know, listening, it was basically a sprite solution. So instead of having a fire sim, which is what we do today, probably as a full-on fire sim. They actually did it with sprites, so effectively particle-based cards that are always orientated towards the camera. So no matter what angle the camera goes at, they're always 90 degrees, thus giving a perfect little projection platform. And those sprite cards, as it were all then mapped with live-action elements that they'd shot. So if you want to have flames burning up, the movement of the flames is defined by the particle system's dynamics on the cards. But what you see is not the cards. You see a real flame on those cards. This gives you a tremendous sense of realism, but you get the flexibility of being able to animate it and control it the way you can a particle system. I believe that was about a month in R&D, and they had 6 weeks to actually do it, and it had a team of 5 people. And I thought that character was probably the most impressive of the digital characters. Did anyone else call me on that one?
No, I agree. That was awesome.
I had some issues in the chase sequence of that section where they used fully digital characters for the Fellowship guys. Now, I'm not talking about going over the bridge, which I think was a really brilliant shot, but there are a couple of other shots that I swear to God looked almost game-like in their kind of, you know, it was the Nintendo Pac-Man escape through the caves. But that's a harsh criticism, but it just, I think, really is more testament to the fact that motion capture has come a long way since then.
And I think if you've got all the shots looking so good, it's easy to spot the ones that aren't hitting the same mark.
What did you guys think of the cave troll, Mark?
That's a great... I mean, I think it... I don't know. I thought it worked pretty well. He's mostly in the dark. I don't know. Are we... I mean, I'm not sure whether to answer that question technically or just... I mean, dramatically, it's great. And I know they faced a kind of a difficulty with the main bad guys in this story being abstract, so they had to make these kind of boss monsters along the way, like ultimately Lurtz. And I don't know. I mean, I thought it had good weight, mass.
On Avatar, Jim Cameron had a virtual camera, which was to say he had a camera that he could put on his shoulders and walk around with. And that camera had projected in an eyepiece the digital world. So as he looked up, he saw up in the digital world. He looked down, he saw the down in the digital world. This actually was something that was done on this film in that scene with the cave troll. So to get the action happening, they motion captured the performances of what they wanted to go on in the room. They then placed those motion captures in a virtual room. So now you had the action playing out. How do I film it? Well, they then gave Peter Jackson a rig, which was an AR or VR rig, where he had stereoscopic vision to both eyes and a wooden dummy camera, but the wooden dummy camera was being motion tracked in real time, and then using what was effectively gaming engine type technology on the SGI stations, wherever he looked around with his virtual stick camera, the computer tracked that and then projected into his eyes what he would be seeing. So to design the handheld nature of the cinematography, he actually worked as a virtual cameraman in a digital space. So when he was coming to do that, like, how am I going to film the troll? There was no one there. There was nothing there. It was just a big empty space and him walking around with a piece of wood, albeit a very elaborate piece of wood with tracking markers all over it. But I thought that was pretty interesting because it's so relevant, I guess, to what we've just seen with Avatar.
Yeah, you know, I actually, now that you mentioned, I remember hearing about that at the time and thinking it must have been pretty crude, and it probably was, but it also, you're right, was quite visionary of where we are now.
I mean, what you wouldn't have got dramatically that you would have had on Avatar is a chance to see some performance from the actors. But he wasn't doing it the way Cameron was, where the performance of the actors was an issue. He was doing it for basically blocking out camera moves vis-a-vis the space. So, you know, I will look up here and then he throws a guy over there, so I'll spin round. But this is the spin happens much more, you know, naturally, because on a computer you'd sort of anticipate the throw a bit, or it wouldn't just be that. But when he literally throws his arm to see where the character has been thrown, he'll find it at the right speed and it'll look really natural because he was he was doing it in a virtual sense but in a very real sense at the same time. And I just think it was a pretty interesting sequence. As I said, I had a couple of problems with going down the giant miniature staircase stuff. Also because I guess I'm not really a fantasy guy, and at some point it just seemed like a really odd way to build something.
That's exactly what I thought. It's like, well, you build these wonderful monuments and these huge grand halls, but weird rickety staircases.
Let's build a deliberately stupid staircase, yeah. And I guess that's the funny thing, isn't it? Because I want there to be backstory on all this stuff. Of course, there's a point at which you can't convey the backstory, but whenever I see something, I guess, well, that just seems like, why would you do that? You know, it's like, why would you build the impossibly sort of stupid thing over here. And there's always some reason that some society thought it was a good idea. But in that particular case, I was like, well, you're now in a video game. You're in a puzzle trying to solve this thing and get out. And it's, I just, I don't know, it just for me, it wasn't a big success.
It does put you in mind how they were both slavishly devoted to the text and taking great liberties with how they interpreted it. They sort of did both.
Yeah. I mean, my problems with it technically, I think, are just the fact that they had like a 12-camera motion capture rig and it was harder to do stuff back then. But any criticisms I have of that motion capture get swept away in the tide of respect that I have for Stephen Regelis' work doing Massive, or rather the first incarnation of that, which was basically to motion capture a bunch of actions and then produce intelligent agents, as they're called, that would react. And did you guys ever see, I don't know if it's made it on, I'm sure it's probably on YouTube, but it, I don't think it's on any of the special feature stuff, the early Massive tests that went wrong?
No.
Have you ever seen those? Have you seen them, Mark?
I heard descriptions where the guys are running away.
Yeah, it was just so funny. I saw them at a presentation, I think it was like a SIDGRAPH type of thing. And, you know, the idea of the agents, for those of you that are listening and aren't quite up to speed on those, is that you give them a set of instructions, but also a set of responses. So, you know, my objective is to go this way and kill this guy. It would be a very simple one. But your objective is obviously to not kill the guys that are on your side, but to kill the guys on the other side, but to achieve an objective. And if there's something in the way, then you respond to what's in the way in a certain characteristic fashion. So if somebody is in front of you that's an enemy, you might have a programmed response, which is to slash at them because you happen to carry swords. If you're carrying a spear, then different bit of the programming kicks in and you throw spear. And so one of the objectives was to literally have army on the right, army on the left, and the idea was to get to the other side as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, in one of these cases, one of the agents worked out that mathematically actually was easier just to run around the other side of the universe, exit on frame right, and come back in at the back on frame left. So as the entire sort of force charges from camera right to camera left, one guy suddenly turns around and hightails it in the opposite direction, which of course looks very funny, like he's a coward, but in fact he was just responding to his programming. But I must admit,
if I was a simulator, I'd do the same.
Yeah, I must admit, that being said, which is like really obviously very funny, that ability to put tens of thousands of characters, I guess, on screen, that's one of the things that I think made Lord of the Rings really epic. It was, you know, it was the thing that up until that point you just couldn't afford to shoot that many passes of green screen people. It would be very repetitive just to clone and repeat. You could do it with sprites, but there were limitations. But with this software, you could fly a camera around a battlefield. And we've seen it so many times now, from Narnia to whatever. But when I first saw it on screen, I was like, oh my God, this defines now epic. But look, I mean, it's such a interesting thing when there's a point in time that you can so identify a new technique and then it takes on wide-scale adoption. I mean, today, actually, a single individual can quite happily run a massive simulation and do everything from traffic to, like they did in King Kong, to, I mean, okay, sure, on a mummy film, you might have like four or five guys on the massive team. But if you're going commercial, a single person can take a massive license and produce a really visually interesting crowd sim. And that's from stadiums to enormous armies and stuff. But it just adds so much production value, I reckon. It's just one of those really, and it's so rare we have like one point you can say, right, that's it. That's the moment that the world just got, you know, tick that box. I can now add as many actors as I want.
I remember when Massive was, back then, that Massive artists were like rock stars. They were getting limos from the airport and to and from their hotels when going to new clients every day. I mean, they were just, everyone loved them because they had this magic. They just had this magic that no one knew about.
You know, to demonstrate how right you are about this too, I counted, it's less than a dozen shots in the prologue that really are making use of it. It didn't take much to get everybody, especially putting it right in the front of the film like that, mm-hmm. to just get everybody's imagination feeling like, wow, I've never seen this before. And nobody, allegedly the era of that type of movie died, the Ben-Hur era,
yep.
of, thousands of extras. So that reassured and improved upon because of what you could do with a camera. Because that's really what Massive is truly about, is the ability to move the camera.
Yeah, because if you can just, you know, duplicate and repeat like a crowd in a stadium and it's from the same angle, then it's relatively easy to do a bit of color correction. And
yeah.
But if it's, yeah, flying down over two armies charging at each other and over terrain, and I mean, in time, of course, it got more and more complicated. They could leave footprints where they'd been and you know, became just so elaborate. And I full cred to the Massive software guys who are still based in New Zealand, because I think they've done brilliant things with it since the early days. But you're right. It's sticking it in the prologue, which is actually, I don't mean to be cynical about this, but it's the bitchinest way to just get an audience fired up. You basically give them something that's otherwise normally be at the end of a film that you'd have to wait several hours to get to and say, look, it's worth hanging around for this film because this is the kind of stuff we're going to be doing in it. Honest, check this out. And then, you know, you cut to Baggins and, you know, gorgeous kind of green countryside, but you're thinking in the back of your head, yeah, let's get back to that like epic warfare stuff.
Yeah, that shot where the camera flies down over the cliff and you just see all those orcs and fairies go head to head, that was an amazing shot.
It was just extraordinary. I don't think, as I said, personally, it was the use of miniature, the scale stuff that had me most intrigued. I'm most impressed in one sense with the massive miniatures or the bigatures, but from a technical point of view, you just can't go past, in my opinion, Massive as being a reason why this film was Oscar credited. Can I say, if you just had to pick a crowd sequence attack thing, wouldn't this like be the first thing that comes to mind? Wouldn't Lord of the Rings still today, 10 years later, be the first thing that comes to mind? Mark?
It's hard to get away from that spoof, the beer ad, but yeah.
Do you want to explain that?
Well, I mean, since this did usher in this new era of, yeah, you can just do this, then it went to its logical conclusion of, yeah, and it deserves parody because now everybody is just doing it. And so let's use Carmina Burana, the most overused action movie soundtrack, and spoof the whole thing. And it was really well done. I think it was a London house that did that. I'm not sure which one.
The big ad was actually done by Animal Logic.
I had no idea.
Yep.
All right. Hats off, Australia.
Andrew Jackson was the VFX supervisor, actually. And yes, it was very reminiscent, though, of what you at the time was kind of the British Airways ads, where you'd have, like, you know, hundreds of people running around forming pictures of the globe with coloured outfits on. So your reference to England was probably a sort of a very artistically valid reference to a style that was pretty darn owned by that British Airways campaign.
You know, Mike, all we know here in the US is it was a furin ad. That's all we knew.
It was for beer.
So we should probably wind up there unless I guess we should do what we normally do, which I am hesitant to do because it seems so cruel. But were there aspects of the film that disappointed? Do you think that in terms of visual effects, that things that didn't quite get there that maybe later films did manage to tackle? I've already indicated that I thought the motion capture for the isolated Fellowship members running through after the or as they're escaping was not, I think, I mean, it took me out of the film. I just found it almost comical. But I, you know, love so much stuff of this film, I sort of hesitate to do it. But Mark, was there anything that didn't work for you?
Yeah, I hate to do this too. Actually, I haven't said my favorite shot, so I want to get to that.
Well, you get to do both then.
I'll give the bad news first. The effect on Galadriel, I mean, in general, the ring distortion stuff, which now I think is a little dated feeling, particularly on her, it just felt a little bit too median filter kind of. And I guess it seems particularly a shame when you have that beautiful an actress and you kind of make her look, I mean, she was meant to look ghoulish, don't get me wrong. She's supposed to be, you know, turning bad by her lust for the ring, but it just got a little crude.
It did feel like a digital effect as opposed to some of the more, dare I use the word, organic effects around it. But if that's your worst, what's your best?
So this is an 18-frame effect of Bilbo when he sees the ring go into Frodo's shirt and he makes his last his last ditch effort to grab it. And they built a prosthetic head version of him. It's a Hitchcock trick where they did a little subtle head replacement on his reaction, and it's just morphed in. It's a morph over 18 frames, and he just turns monstrous. And it's from the book. Actually, the book describes his expression becoming something horrid. I'm not going to quote it properly, but
it really makes you jump, that shot.
It does. It makes you jump, and I think it was used so in such a restrained way. I mean, actually, I think Hitchcock was not very restrained in his use of it with Norman Bates, but this I thought was really great and such a little thing, and I think emblematic of the kind of general approach on this movie of A, whatever works, and B, you know, getting most of what you want in camera and then goosing it a little bit with another practical element.
Yeah. It's like anything that's referenced to Hitchcock, basically. You score 5 more points for that. Matt, you?
Things I didn't like so much. Yeah, like I mentioned, some of the background replacements, just not sitting right with the foreground element. And, you know, now watching it on your big shiny plasma or LED screen, you can see a lot more of the comping issues, which I don't think I saw when it was on the big screen in film.
And, you know, to be fair, we've got to get a Blu-ray of this thing. I was bummed to be trying to look at the massive
stuff.
There is
no Blu-ray. I tried buying
not
a Blu-ray.
Yet. No. Well, there is no Blu-ray. April, apparently. It looks like they're winding up for a release of this and the animated version in April, according to what I see on Amazon.
There is going to be a Blu-ray?
Yeah, Blu-ray of the trilogy plus the 1978 animated Lord of the Rings all on the same day. April 6th, 2010 is what I see for pre-order right here.
How many extra discs do you think we'll get?
Well, Blu-ray, maybe you don't have to.
But I mean, a lot of that behind-the-scenes footage is, you know, low-res PAL kind of stuff, so I don't know how amazing that's going to be blown up to HD. If I'm really going to get that much more.
No, but I think just for all this great background stuff, it would just look a lot better if it didn't have MPEG 2 on it.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't touched on it much, but I do think that the color grading on this film like deserves the best transfer possible, because this was a really nicely graded film.
And not all DI, right? This was prior to the era of doing a full DI. Especially
I can't remember
this
prior to DI anymore.
Yeah, pre-DI, color timing.
I know, but it's amazing when a film looks like it had a full DI and didn't, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it was spectacularly well graded, and yet you're right, like it didn't have every trick in the book. And doing color timing without a DI is really hard work. You probably, hopefully you guys listening to this don't actually have to ever to do it, but it's, you know... Somebody says, oh, can you just make it a bit more contrasty? No, there is no contrast. Well, I just want to make it. No, all you got to do is add points or take points away from these four settings. That's it. Okay. Well, look, I think we should finish up there. To paraphrase Frodo, I'm glad we're back. So am I, dear boy. So am I. And I'm glad you're back with us. It's been a while since we've had you on the show, Mark. I'm very apologetic about that not happening earlier, because we always like having you on the show.
No, it's been maybe 6 weeks. No, it's good.
Where can we get you, people sort of track you down, follow you, and stalk you?
I'll do the usual, give Flowseeker on Twitter. Just my difficult to spell name led me to that moniker.
Well, I'm certainly a Flowseeker follower. And Matt, who basically hates Twitter.
I don't hate Twitter. I'm just not quite there yet. But I'm on the Book of Face or over at fxphd.com.
Brilliant. And, of course, I'm over at FX Guide. And as I kind of mentioned at the outset of the show, we've changed a few things with the show. And one of the things is that the VFX show is now moving full-time, as it were, to fxguide.com. So there'll be more about that coming up, but we'll actually be including it much more on the FX Guide site. And we appreciate you guys staying with us, and we appreciate the fact that We've been trying to get these out every fortnight. It's a little difficult. We want to thank in particular Todd, who's our producer and also has done research for the show. Todd is one of our behind-the-scenes team. We have a really good set of people that work together to get this out. Obviously, everybody's working, has full-time jobs, so we really appreciate the effort that goes in. We respond directly to your feedback. In fact, I think this suggestion of Lord of the Rings was something that was sent in. So if you have something that you'd like to let us know about, please go over to our either our show Twitter feed, which is the VFX show, or to the VFXshow.com and give us your comments or feedback or suggestions for other films you'd like to see us review. We have other films coming up. We're going doing, as we always do, a mix of new and old films. I'm really looking forward to a few ones like Book of Eli myself coming up. But I think I'm the only one, but we'll see how that goes. But all of that coming up and more. I want to thank you both for being with us. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
And thank you, Matt.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
And we'll talk to you guys next time. See you.